force, and finally they organized them, and the union made them stay there. They said, you wanted to come out here, so now here you're going to stay, because what are we going to do now with these people we organized over here? Okay. So, until, I won't say it, 5 or 6 years, more than that. Then they went out of business altogether, Fort Wayne. But then I worked at C.B. Shane, and after I was there a while, I was a chairlady there. So I worked as a chairlady there for many, many years, over 20 years. From there, I went to Hart Schaffner Marx when C.B. Shane went out of business. They actually, the boss died, and two son-in-laws, one was a CPA, and the other one was in real estate or some darn thing, and he only had two daughters, so he had nobody to take over the business, so they sold their business to a firm from Cleveland. And so again, we're out of work. So that's when I went into Hart's. I worked at Hart's for 12 years. And so I retired. And I was an assistant chairlady at Hart's for a while.
What do you think influenced you the most to join the union?
Oh, the conditions. The conditions, you know, before you joined the union, if the boss didn't like what you looked like, or maybe he'd try to make a date with you and you'd say no or something, so he'd say, well, I'm sorry, you're out of a job. Well, when we joined the union, there was no such thing.
Was that a pretty common practice? Did that happen a lot?
Well, I never had that experience, but I understand that it happened a lot. The only experience I had that if I didn't belong to the union, I'd have been out of there a long time, was my coming in late. I used to come in late, and it seems like I like to sleep in the morning. Even now, I go to bed 2-3 o'clock in the morning. But I like to sleep late, you know, I get up 10 o'clock, 10:30 this morning, I got up 9:30. And it seems like when I was working nights, and I used to only get 5 hours sleep, I got so used to that, you know, I'm a night person, in other words. I'm not watching television now, I'm either knitting or I'm reading or doing something, but I never, even when I worked, could go to bed before 12, 1 o'clock. But I used to like to sleep in the morning, so then I'd make a beeline for work, and I was always 5-10 minutes late. So that just would break my boss, you know. So he used to give me a complaint slip. After you got 3 of those pink slips, then you used to get a suspension. Then you'd be suspended for a week, and you'd lose a week's wages. Well, I had a post. There was a big post alongside of where I worked, and I used to stick them up on that post, you know. I had a picture. Well, I was such a devil that the boss, even though I used to aggravate him, he never gave me the third suspension slip. He always gave me a complaint. So I had him strung up on the post there. You know, like I was ridiculing him or something. So I said to myself, you know, if I didn't belong to the union, I'd have been out of here. He'd have fired me a long time ago. But outside of that, I never had any trouble. My work was always good. In fact, I'm a perfectionist. When I do anything, if I can't do it right, I don't want to do it. And my work never suffered. The only time they would fire you if you got caught stealing or if your work was so bad that the union couldn't do anything for you, which has happened, you know, that people just won't adapt themselves. But in my experience as a chairlady, I never had that happen. A few people, for being dishonest, were let out. And in fact, I had one experience while I was chairlady that somebody lost their job. He was cheating on the coupons, you know. So I was called in the office, and when I worked at Shane, I had very good employers there. We had Dave Shane, which was a brother. He was head charge of the office, so he calls me down there, and he tells me there's a certain party. Every week he's cheating on his coupons, And some people only get paid for holidays according to what you earned the previous week, you know, what your rate was, they used to pay for your holidays. So they used to take a whole bag of coupons from the week previous and put them in that week so that they would get more for that one holiday, you know. We used to have, there's always a bad apple in the barrel, you know, to spoil the rest. The same thing with the smoking. We weren't allowed to smoke in the shop, you could smoke out in the hall. Well, the women used to go and smoke in the washroom. Well, we had a cement floor. That was all good and well. What's going to stop you from throwing your match and your cigarette in the toilet? Why throw it on the floor? Because this boss of mine, every once in a while, he'd go and inspect washrooms to see if anybody was smoking in there. And when I used to go into the washroom, I used to see cigarette butts on the floor. I'd pick it up and put it in the toilet and flush the toilet. I said, I'm not the janitor. I said, if you women aren't smart enough to throw it in the toilet, I said, you should get fired. They have containers out in the hall. You can go out there and smoke anytime you want. Why do it in the washroom if you can't, you know, hide it? We had windows there. They'd open up the window. And well, this one time with this man about cheating with the coupons, I was so provoked when I came up from the office to think that on account of a few people, we have to have all kinds of rules and regulations, you know. Because he says, from now on, the coupons have to be in by 9 o'clock Monday morning so that they can't accumulate some from Monday and put them in too, you know. And I came up and I'm talking to myself and I'm testing one of the girls' machine, and she looked at him, Maria, you're talking to yourself? I said, yeah, on account of some lousy son of a gun, son of a bee, they say, on account of some lousy son of a gun, bees around here, I says, now we're going to have more rules and regulations. She says, well, what happened? I said, well, people are cheating on the coupons, I says, and now we're going to have a sign on the clock when the coupon books have to be in. And so the fella that's sitting in front of her gets up like a shot out of hell. He says, so you're calling me a son of a bitch? He says, bang. He swung at me and I went like that and his fist just scaled my face over here, you know. And if I wouldn't have seen that fist coming and I ducked my head, I had a pretty nice shiner. So right away, some of the men got up and they grabbed him, you know, and the foreman grabbed me because I was going to pick up a chair and hit him over the head with it. So right away, the boss come up from downstairs and he got fired. So I called up the business agent and he come over and I told him what happened. And so this guy was waiting for me every morning. He waited for me out in the street because I used to ride the elevator to work. And on Wells and Madison, he'd stand there and wait. So the boss had our machinist, who was a big, strappy guy. He used to come over there to meet me every morning. And when I was going home, he'd take me to the L. So I went and had a warrant sworn out for him. You know, they told me to swear out a warrant, so I had a warrant sworn out for him. So for about 2 weeks, the police were looking for him. They could never find him. So finally, he went down to the union. He was Italian. And he spoke to the Italian business agent, Mike Ginobili, and told him that, please, to see that I would get his job back and this and that and the other thing. No way, he told him at the union. You were wrong, and then on top of being wrong, you struck a woman, a chair lady at that. There's no way that you're going to get your job back. So he was out of work for about 2 years. That is, he wasn't in our shop. I don't know what kind of work he did, but he didn't come back to our shop for, about 2 years. Finally, one day, my boss called me, and he was a pretty good operator. He was fast, and they needed work very desperately in his line at the time. So one day, I get a call down in the office, Mr. Shane says, and he's sitting there, you know. So Mr. Shane says, Marie, Alfonso's here, and he'd like to come back to work for it. You know, I could use him. But it's up to you. If you say no, it's no. So, he says, don't you think he suffered enough? You know, because his wife was working there. His wife was working there right along. And she knew that he was hot-tempered, and so she really didn't blame him. She blamed him, because he struck her one time, you know, at work. So anyway, he come up and he knelt down and he was trying to kiss my hand. You know, he was an old timer, you know, one of those guys that kisses your hand. So he said, I'll apologize in front of everybody and all that, this and that and the other thing. He wanted to come up and apologize to me in front of the whole shop. I said, no, we don't have to make a show out of it. I said, but if you think you've earned your lesson, I said, all right, so take him back. So then he came back to work. And then after that, he became one of the best friends that I had. I have two older brothers and myself, and they were both married. And there was five kids home. So
was
then
this during the time you were going to school too?
No. I left school right after grammar school. I didn't go to high school because in those days, you know, when you had a big family, eight children, we weren't required to go to. That is. If you wanted to go to high school, it was all right, and if not, why, you didn't have to go. But you had to go to continuation school, which was one day a week. So where I worked, when the tool officer used to come to see if there was anybody there, you know, that should have been in school, I used to go in the washroom and hide. So I never did go to continuation school. I used to enjoy working so much that I wouldn't go to school. But at that time, my father was still living. I could have continued my education, you know. But, you know, he had the six of us at home. My mother and father was eight. And I figured whatever little money I made came in handy. And at least I had enough to buy my own clothes. I used to be a clothes horse in my young days. I used to like nice things. So I went to work early. But then when my father died in 1920, then I had to work in order to support them.
Did you take that upon yourself, or did your family make you feel that it was your responsibility? Or?
I took it upon myself, and then what family did I? I had my mother. My mother never worked a day in her life. I didn't want her to go out and work, so I just got myself an extra job. And then I have an aunt, my mother's younger sister, who is 96 now. She never had any children. So she, in order to relieve me of one mouth to feed, she asked if she could take one of my younger sisters to live with her. In fact, she wanted to adopt her, but my mother wouldn't stand for it. She says, no, she's an Alioto, and that's what she's going to remain, you know. So she took this sister of mine, who was about 8 years old at the time, to live with her. And my aunt raised her. She got married in Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, she got married out there. She raised two sons. Now she's a grandmother, and she's still living in Milwaukee. And my aunt moved to California with her husband, and so my uncle got real sick, and he was on his dying bed, and he said he wanted to die in Chicago or Milwaukee. So she brought him back here. So now my aunt is 96, and she's living with my sister in Milwaukee. My sister's a widow now, and her two sons got married, so she's got a big home there, and she takes care of my aunt, and I take care of my mother. So she called my aunt Mama, and she called my mother Mama. So she's got two mothers. But this sister that I live with, she's the youngest of the girls, and I have a brother that's 3 years younger than her. My sister is going to be 62. And my brother is 59. He's a baby. And he was only 5 years old when my father died.
Do you think that you were in a unique position at that point, or were there a lot of younger women that you knew at that time that were supporting families and in employment?
Well, I didn't know of too many that were supporting families, but I know a lot of the women that I know today that were working at that time, whether they were working that they had to support families. I know one particular one that her mother was a widow and she went to work. She only had maybe 1 year or so of high school and she had to go to work. But there was a lot of young women at that time working when I started. Because as I say, it wasn't compulsory that we had to go to high school like it is today, you know. Of course, you had these dropouts. But you still have to start going to high school when you get out of grammar school. See, in those days, we didn't have that law.
Do you think that's why there were a lot of...
Yeah, I think so. See, like in Europe, where my mother comes from, my mother's been here from Italy about 73 years. And when she was a kid, they didn't have to go to school. But my youngest aunt, she had to go to school, see, because the laws changed. Mussolini got in, you know, and he made them all go to school. See, when my mother was raised on a farm. So they had to help the father and the brothers with the farm work. So they didn't go to school. So my mother can't read and write Italian. But my youngest aunt had to go to school. See, so she got an education. The same thing like when I was young, we didn't have to go to high school if we didn't want to. And if you wanted to go to work, and you know, when you start working and you get those few dollars in your pocket where you can spend it the way you want and not have to depend on your mother to give you a dime or a quarter to go to the show. So, it's just like nowadays, these dropouts, you know, they started working, they start earning a few dollars and they just drop out of school. But then when I had to work in order to raise the other kids, I didn't want them to... We didn't have to go to welfare. We didn't go to the county for anything. No, sir. And we always lived in a nice place, you know, a nice neighborhood. I wouldn't say it was a ghetto in those days when we lived around there. But stove heat, gas. We had a bathroom in the house, yeah. And I don't remember ever living in any place where we had to go out in the yard to the washroom. But, we always liked nice things, and I just went to work and enjoyed it and brought the money home. Gigi, come on, you're a pest. Get out of here. Get up here.
Could you describe your neighborhood to me a little bit more?
Well, the neighborhood where I lived in was Italian, Irish, and Jewish. In fact, our landlord was Jewish. He had a little dragon store across the street. And it's there at 922 Sedgwick, which was right off between Oak and Chicago Avenue. And mostly it was Italian. Mostly it was Italian. Well, in those days, we had a lot of gangsters, you know. They used to call them Black Hand then.
They used to call them what?
The Black Hand. Then they started calling them the Mafia and all that. There was a lot of killing going on, but among themselves, you know. And then during Prohibition, the bootleggers got in, and they used to fight among themselves and all that. But they never
all
thought...
within your neighborhood?
Well, a lot of them lived in that neighborhood. And, but I went to the John Quincy Adams School, and it was a very nice school. Then on Oak Street, Oak and Milton, they had the Jenner School, but I went to the John Quincy Adams School. And I was born and raised there. we moved out of there about, about 45 years ago. And the neighborhood has changed tremendously since then. In fact, they had an Italian church there, which they knocked it down. I don't know if I should say this. Maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. Because when they put up those Mother Cabrini homes there, nobody was going to the Italian church. Nobody was supporting it. A few Puerto Ricans would go, but nobody else. But those are things that I don't want to talk about. I don't think I should. But we had a good time in the neighborhood there.
Are there any particular experiences or stories that you remember about growing up there?
I don't know. Nothing specific, you know, nothing special. Just regular, you know, growing up among the kids there and playing and roller skating and all that. And then going to work. I used to work at the Windsor Theater, which is where the Sandberg Village is now, you know, on Clark and Eugene. The Windsor Theater was there. And so I used to walk to work because if I rode, I could only ride for 4 blocks, and I had to walk 4 blocks, so I figured I might as well walk, you know. And at night, there was a dance hall there at North Avenue and Clark Street. They used to call it the Columbia Hall, and my two older brothers used to hang around there. And the kids in those days were different. Nobody smoked pot. Nobody was a drinker. They never had these drunken parties, and they used to love to dance. In fact, one sister of mine that died, she would rather dance than eat. And her and a brother of mine that's 3 years younger than I am, they used to do exhibition dancing. And in those days, they used to do the bolero and the tango and all that. And so they used to go there every night. And this sister of mine was an instructor at this dance hall. She was only 16, mind you, but she looked older. And so after I get through working at the show at 10:30, after I check in my cash and everything like that, I used to take a walk down there, which was only a block and a half, and I'd go and dance for a few hours and get home at 12 o'clock. Get up at 7 in the morning and go to work again. So that's what I used to do. And that's the only thing that I remember. Then we organized the boys, my younger brothers and I, some friends in the neighborhood. They started a club, which they called the Owl Indians Club. And then the girls joined the club. So it was a mixed group. There was about 75 boys, I think, about 50 boys and 25 girls. We were 75 altogether. And they organized this club, and they rented a club room, and as a coincidence, there was two police women lived in an apartment in front of this little hall that they had in the back, you know, right across from Winton Park. And the first time that we run a social there, the police almost raided us. So somebody called up the police and told them that there was a disorderly house there. And we didn't know that these women were police women. We used to have refreshments, because there was a little kitchen there and all that, and we invited them because they came out in the hall and we asked them to come in. So every time we'd have something, we'd always ask them to come in and have some refreshments. So, and most of the fellows were going steady with these girls, you know. In fact, my sister was going steady with her husband, and my brother was going steady with his wife that he still has today. And I was the only one that wasn't going steady with anybody because I was working at the show, and on my day off, I was active at the club. I was also the treasurer of the club there. And
did that bother you at all, Marie?
I don't know. Because all my activity was after 10:30. You know, that's when the fun started. You know, that's why I say I got along with very little sleep. That's why I almost got a nervous breakdown from, you know, the hours I was keeping. Not that the work was high. So anyway, when they came up the stairs there, because it was a big long step from the sidewalk to the second floor, and they had the front apartment, and you walked through like a gangway, and there was this one big room there with a little kitchenette and a washroom, you know. We had a pool table and a player piano up there, and some of the boys in the club played instruments, so we had our own band. So we were running this golden apple party, I remember it was. We strung apples on the ceiling, you know, and then we stick a button in the core of the apple, and the girls dance with the fellas, and they'd reach up and grab an apple, and it was up to the boys to prevent them, because every apple that they would bring down, they had to pay a nickel. See? And then if they'd eat the apple and find the button, they would get a prize, you know, $2.50 gold piece. We could get gold pieces in those days. So when the police started coming up the stairs there, these women went out to find out what they wanted there, and they said, we got a call that there's a disorderly house back there. And they said, listen, those are a bunch of kids having a good time. They showed their credentials. They told them who they were. We're police women. They used to patrol Lincoln Park, you know, there for muggers and all that stuff. And if there's anything going on over there that shouldn't be going on, we'd be the first to know. So they made the police go down. They came in and told us girls later that we almost got raided, you know. From that time on, we were never bothered anymore. We used to run socials once a month. Charge a quarter, you know, admission. So like other people from the neighborhood that didn't belong, you know, other kids would come there and dance and Halloween party. And a lot of these fellas were going to school. In fact, the president was my dentist for many, many years. And one of them today is a lawyer. My brother belonged to the club and for many, many years after that. But when the girls start getting married, some of them dropped out, you know, and all that. But the boys kept it up. They used to call me All Indian Social Women's Life Club. They had baseball teams. They used to sponsor kids in the neighborhood, you know, like bats and the ball and the gloves and all that. Yeah, well, that's one of the nice times that I had when I was a young kid. I mean, a teenager. So, side of that, going to Old Spring Beach, going to Lincoln Park. I remember the first car that my brother bought, he paid $40 for a pile of junk, you know, with a running board. We had more fun with that car. It was a 7-passenger touring car without a top. And we used to go to all the ball games, and they used to pile us all in, and some stand on the running board, and we'd go to the ball game.